That unruffled beat is Clouds Below Your Knees by Texas native Ray Lynch, signaling that it's Thursday, 10 p.m., and time for So, What's Your Story? Hi, I'm Warren Holloman, Professor of Behavioral Science at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Well, that's my day job, but on Thursday evenings, I team up with Laura Sheinkoff, Greg Aldell, Hank Rubicek, and Jacob Reiner to bring you the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on Listener Sponsor 90.1 KPFT Houston. Tonight, Jacob is here, as always, working the boards. Hi, Jake.
How you doing tonight, Warren?
I'm doing great. I understand you got a free week coming up next week?
Yes, I do. Tomorrow, I will be starting my drive to Colorado.
Oh, way to go. Spring break?
Yes. Yes, long time coming.
Oh, that's exciting. And I hope you come home with some good stories.
Thank you. Thank you.
Jacob and I do this show because we believe our civilization simply can't survive without stories. Can you put a price tag on the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Bible, the Vedic scriptures, the Quran? These stories shape our character as individuals. They shape our values as a culture and as a community. And so do the stories that we tell on this show. All these stories, wherever they come from, challenge us to rethink questions of our individual and our cultural identity. They raise questions about life's purpose, life's meaning. And they don't just raise questions. They give us guidelines, sometimes even answers. And speaking of purpose, meaning, our storytelling guest tonight is a psychologist who practices a form of psychotherapy that focuses on issues of purpose and meaning. Dr. Michael Winters, welcome to So What's Your Story?
I'm really glad to be here.
We're glad to have you back. We're delighted that you're here. I'm guessing that many, probably most of our listeners, have some idea of what the psychotherapy process is like in general, but they may not know much about your particular approach.
Okay. Well, I practice what's called logotherapy, and that's a long story, so I won't get into that, or meaning-based psychotherapy, meaning-centered psychotherapy, and it really believes that everybody, no matter what situation they're in, there is some meaning that can be discovered, and when you find that meaning, then everything changes and you're able to cope in ways that you didn't know you were able to before. So that's the short answer to that. What's different about meaning-centered psychotherapy than some other forms?
Excellent. And actually, at the end of the show, if we have time, we're going to ask you to tell a little story about how logotherapy came to be. It's an amazing story. Yep. I'm very familiar with it myself. But for now, I'd like you to tell a story that will describe sort of how logotherapy works. It's a story, I understand, about a college student who's feeling pressured to follow in his father's footsteps.
Yep. And I do need to preface this with, this is not the actual events because I want to protect the confidentiality of the client and that kind of thing. So there are some liberties taken and making sure you don't know who this person is from the story.
Yes, and I'm guessing you could tell aggregates of, you've heard this story many times in many ways.
Yep. Yeah. But the essential heart of it is the same.
Yeah.
So shall I jump in?
Go for it.
Okay. So I met Joe when he was a sophomore in college, and he really did not believe that he had any value at all. He had come from a really difficult childhood. Both his parents got divorced when he was young, and they were both kind of centered on themselves and not really available for Joe. So he grew up not really feeling cared about, not feeling very valued. And the other thing that he believed he had to do, because his father was an attorney and both grandfathers on both sides were attorneys, and there was this belief that he needed to be an attorney. That was the only way he was going to make it in life. And so working with Joe, this was really tough because he didn't believe me. I tried to understand his pain and tried to point out ways that he was an adequate human being, that, you know, he was making good grades at a tough college. You know, he believed that he was really ugly, but to me, he looked, you know, average or above average in attractiveness, but just didn't believe in himself and didn't believe that I could do anything to help him. But early in the therapy, we did have one kind of breakthrough. We were talking about hope and talking about, you know, kind of finding meaning. And he looked at me and said, "Great Britain." I was like, "What's he talking about?" He said, early in World War II, Germany was bombing Great Britain relentlessly. And it would have been pretty easy for them to just give up. But the consequences of giving up were dire. Mm-hmm. So they didn't give up. They persisted. And ultimately, we know that they were victorious and the Germans didn't win. And so that became kind of a touchstone. When we got to a place where he was starting to feel overwhelmed, we would just talk about Great Britain and the mm-hmm. need to persevere. So in working with Joe, there was one time when I was really fearful that he might kill himself. And I actually called another psychologist into the office to help me see if he was okay to go or if I needed to call the hospital and have him involuntarily committed. And, you know, Joe wasn't happy about that. But I think he saw that his safety was my highest priority and that I cared about him and that I cared about his life, even if he didn't care about his life. So Joe, you know, he came into therapy off and on, sophomore through senior year, and he was one of the things that he really believed was that he would never find a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And then he feared that if he did find a girlfriend, she would, of course, dump him, and then that would prove that he was unlovable. Mm-hmm. So about his junior year, he did find a girlfriend, and then I started getting worried, what happens if this relationship doesn't work? But Joe surprised himself. About 2 months after they started dating, she did, in fact, end the relationship. But instead of going back to his old self-criticism, he realized that he didn't want to be in a relationship with somebody that didn't want to be with him. And then later, he was able to go on and date others and, in fact, was able to break up with someone that he realized wasn't a good fit for him. And he empathized with her pain, but said it doesn't make sense if this isn't going to work. So, you know, Joe eventually got into a college that was okay for him and for his family and was able to make changes. And I think my help was really just believing in him and having that persistence.
Right. Wow. I know this was a story about a young man, but... Mm-hmm. Being in the stage of life where I am, I'm still thinking about the parents.
Yeah.
It sounds as though they were trying to be helpful.
As much as they could. I think they were so caught up in their own mm-hmm. tragedy, their own drama, that they couldn't even really see him. They just saw, you know, this pattern. And,
right.
And they were doing what they could, but they didn't really get him.
Right. I mean, and so in being these sort of helicopter parents who mm-hmm. wanted to program their son's life, mm-hmm. they did a lot of harm.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds as though his search to find his identity and his purpose affected his mental health, his relationships,
yeah.
everything.
Yeah. Yeah. He was really didn't believe that there was anything worthwhile about himself when he first came in to see me.
Right. Right. So, I mean, when we talk about depression, talk mm-hmm. about anxiety, things like that, we think in terms of psychiatric categories. We think yeah. in terms of medications.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think in those categories?
Well, you know, I mean, some of it I have to in terms of my job. But really, I think, you know, when people say, what do you treat? I treat problems in living.
Right.
You know, I don't see it as these other categories. And you can, you know, you can think of it through a different diagnostic process. But really just seeing human beings all have faced problems and faced struggles. And how can I be available to help that person find hope, to persevere, to be that great Briton, to, you know, just, right. just last in the face of whatever difficulty they're challenged with.
Was he familiar with that famous Churchill quote, never, 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 never give up?
Probably. I don't remember that specifically, but probably, because he was quite the World War II scholar.
Yeah.
So he really was able to capture that. And that was his metaphor. You know, if I think if I had given that to him, it wouldn't have worked. But because he came up with it, that became our touchstone.
Oh, that's so powerful. And then I try to put myself in his shoes, and I think, wow, in order to get what he needed to be healthy and happy, he, in a sense, had to push his parents away. He had to say, no, this is me, and this is who I am.
Yeah. And find, you know, one part I didn't mention there was, you know, as we talked, he did remember an elementary school teacher that had believed in him and had kind of challenged him to be more than he thought he was capable of being. So that was kind of, you know, we were kind of fishing for those moments and people in his life, because he really didn't feel like his parents cared. You know, they had this mission for him, but they didn't really know him or care about him. And so I was trying to help him find those moments.
Right.
And then find that metaphor and just, you know, build on that. And in a lot of ways, he surprised me, because I was, like I said, I was really fearful. And yet he was able to do things that maybe it was my counsel, maybe it was he found it on his own. But I think being able to have somebody that he could talk to, somebody that heard his pain, but also wasn't willing to just kind of give up like he had given up at times, I think that was the benefit.
Right. And I'm guessing this is a kind of a typical problem for college students?
Yeah, I think it's more common than people recognize. You know, there's a lot of depression, anxiety, you know, career uncertainty, that kind of thing. But just really that identity and who am I and am I okay, you know, it's pretty common, not only college students. I think many people suffer with that or struggle with that.
And I'm guessing it's also a common problem for sort of high-achieving parents of high-achieving children.
Yeah.
They have agenda for their children that they think they're being helpful, but they're not.
Yeah, and it's hard sometimes to see the actual person who's developing in front of you because you just want to go with what you believe. You know, or when they were born, or maybe before they were born, what you thought they were going to be, and just try to shape them into that image rather than see who they really are.
Right, and let them have that time to do that. If you're just joining us, you're listening to So What's Your Story? This is Warren Holloman with Jacob Reiner.
Yes, and we're here with guest storyteller Dr. Michael Winters on listener-sponsored Corporate Free, 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.3 in Livingston.
Jacob and I, along with Hank, Greg, and Laura, like to think our show is one of the best things going in terms of promoting the art of storytelling in the Houston community. But we know there's a lot of other good stuff going on out there.
Indeed there is. On Wednesday, March 16th, from 7 to 9 p.m., storytelling icon Lauren Naemi will be performing a concert at the Printing Museum. The museum is in the Montrose community at 1324 West Clay. You will not want to miss it. Get all the details at www.houstonstorytellers.org. If you do miss the concert, Dr. Lauren will be on Dr. Hank's will be the guest teller on Dr. Hank's show next week on So What's Your Story? And if you do get to that concert, then you certainly don't want to miss the next show. But why would you want to miss any show?
I checked him out on YouTube, listened to a couple of his stories, Jacob, and they were incredible. So I'm looking forward to hearing him live next week. Now back to tonight's guest. Michael, your first story described the paradox of parents who perhaps thought they were being helpful, but they weren't. But in so doing, they actually more or less harm their son because they didn't let him find his own way in life. I understand your next story is about a middle-aged man who tries very hard to help his ailing wife, but also manages perhaps to create some collateral damage in the process.
Could be, could be. Well, let me, this was so let me just jump into this. I was eager to get back to the hospital where Kelly, the woman to whom I married, was suffering from the mother of all infections. And I was in a hurry, but I was calm and collected as I was driving through an intersection. And I saw a van sitting there, and then it was at a stop sign, but it lurched forward, and it, bam! I heard the big bang as the van plowed into the back end of our beloved Prius. And, you know, I was really ticked. I jumped out of the car saying, "What's wrong with you? You had a stop sign." The driver of the van looked at me and said, "I did stop." Well, that really confused me. And I said, "But you hit me." And, you know, I was really kind of confused in a moment. I wasn't hurt, but I was just kind of, everything was kind of in a daze. And I knew that I didn't have a stop sign, that I was driving the speed limit, and there was no way that this accident was my fault. So I could kind of breathe easy there. But, you know, everything was in a haze, and I went over and you know, exchanged information. The van had now parked on near a grassy curb, and we got all the information, and as I stepped back from the van, I realized I was not having a good week. My wife was in the hospital, just been in a car accident, and I realized I'd stepped in dog poop. So,
literally.
Yes. So I was, you know, stepping back and realized, you know, kind of everything was focused on, you have to be alert and aggressive with the other driver. You know, you can't show any weakness. And I looked at the insurance information, and it was like, it was 3 weeks out of date. That has to prove something. And, you know, so we had called 911. We were waiting for the police. Fortunately, nobody was really hurt, and the cars were drivable. And as we waited for the police, I started to think back to another accident. This one was a student of mine, only 28 years old, Kristen. She'd been driving on a two-lane Texas highway, typical Thursday morning. And the car coming the opposite direction veered across and into her car, killing her on impact. And when I'd heard the news of her death, I couldn't believe it. Kristen had been so full of life. She was eager, optimistic, intelligent. You know, I'd met her in teaching a class that was really for advanced counselors. And she had come and asked me to join, and you know, there wasn't a scholarship, but she said, "I'll find the money." And she drove 2 hours each way to come to the class. And in the class, we talked about really difficult things like genocide. And though, you know, she was probably 10 years younger than the next student in age, and yet she was able to handle all those topics with as much grace as anybody in the class. And she was really courageous, too. Most of her colleagues believe in psychology as kind of a technology, kind of like a mental plumbing. Mm-hmm. But she believed in the uniqueness of each individual. To her, counseling was a sacred mission. You know, when I looked at her, I thought, this is the future of psychology. But now she was gone, and I would have to carry that mission myself. My attitude softened quite a bit, and I went back to the other driver, Anita, and I asked how she was doing. She said at first she had been really shaken up and anxious because she'd flashed back to a time that she'd been in an accident and rolled over several times going down an embankment and miraculously had walked away okay. As we talked, I could see that she was relaxing. And she told me, You know, we were standing just yards away from a hospital 25 years before her son had been born in that hospital. Mm-hmm. And I told her, you know, how worried I was about my wife in a hospital several miles away. And she told me she was worried. She was driving a company van. She thought she might lose her job. Well, her boss came, you know, long before the police did. And I told him that I hoped Anita would not be penalized for making a mistake that anybody could have made. And as we talked, you know, I'm not really a very religious person, but I could tell that Anita was. She'd talked about that several times. And I said, you know, I'm not sure why God brought us together today. And I wish it had been under different circumstances. But I'm glad to have met you. So I learned a lot that day. I learned that no matter what it is, anger, anxiety, pain, it will ease with time. I learned that you should always connect with other human beings. And I learned that you can scrape dog poop off your shoe. So eventually the police came and left, and Kelly recovered from the accident. And I realized that, you know, sometimes when worlds and cars collide, one life ends. But other times, a new connection can be formed.
Wow. I love that story. It makes me think of what a community is. You know, we think we're a bunch of individuals heading off on our errands and our very important things to do. Yeah. But then we collide, literally, and we realize how much we have in common. Yeah. We're all in this together.
Yeah.
Wow. The flashback that you had back to that other accident, that's a powerful part of that story.
Yeah.
It's amazing how the brain works.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I had never thought of Kristen as somebody that was going to be in the past tense. This was my hope for our profession.
Yeah.
And then when she died, it was just really powerful beyond, like, you know, like a family member. Mm-hmm. It felt like the loss was much more intense than I would have imagined.
It just strikes me that you had said that you viewed Kristen as the future of the profession.
Mm-hmm.
Even after her death, though, she was performing psychotherapy on you.
Mm-hmm.
She was giving you a different perspective on that accident.
And letting me know, okay, yeah, in that moment, and, you know, she's not there physically to do the work that I thought she would do, so that means I better do it.
Right.
It was a call to action for me to not just relax, but to keep going and to look at what I do in different ways and hopefully deepen what I do.
Yeah. We mentioned at the outset that your form of psychotherapy has, I would say, a little bit of a clunky name, logotherapy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not something that contemporary people really get into unless they studied Greek. But it's actually a very rich word, and it has an even richer history. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that history.
I'll tell you a little bit and just one little micro story. So the book is Dr. Viktor Frankl's chronicle of his experience in a concentration camp. And what's not always known is that he had the idea for this meaning-based therapy before he went into the concentration camp, but he tested his theories under the worst possible conditions. And he, you know, there's a lot of stories in that, but one of my favorite ones is he was acting as a physician in the camps, and there was this woman who was very ill. She was about to die, and she, you know, looked at him, and she could see through her window one branch of a tree. And she said, "That tree is my only friend. And I talked to the tree." Now he thought, you know, she's having hallucinations. He said, "Does the tree answer?" She said, "Yes. It says, I am life. I am eternal life." Hmm. So even in these, you know, conditions that were the worst imaginable conditions that human beings could create, and here was this woman about to die, but she saw something. She was still connected to life, even in these terrible situations, even though she knew she was about to die. And, you know, that's the kind of poetry that is in that book, Man's Search for Meaning. Like I said, there's a lot in there. But I think he shows that no matter how bad your situation is, it's still possible to discover a meaning.
And in fact, what I got out of the book is you have to, or you can't survive. You don't have a chance of survival. That sort of motivates you to fight for your life.
Right. You're living kind of like an animal then, you know, and if you find the meaning, then you move into the truly human realm of what it means to be alive.
Yeah. I remember one person he counseled in the camp. His wife had died already. He said, if I die, our little son, if he survives, will not have a parent. And so I've got to find a way to survive for my son. So that was pretty powerful.
Yeah. It's full of those. And, you know, all of our lives, one of the things he said is everybody carries their own concentration camp with them.
Yeah.
You know, we all have our suffering. It's not about comparing suffering, but it's finding the meaning that helps us live through it no matter what the situation is. How do we do that? What's our story that allows us to live even in a lot of pain?
Michael, I love your stories. I've thoroughly enjoyed getting to know you, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. And I definitely hope you'll come back.
Well, I would love to come back sometime.
We'd love to have you back. And by the way, I should have said that second story you told is the story you told last week at the Moth Grand Story Slam to 1,600 people, I believe.
Yeah.
And now you're telling it one-on-one to me, so I'm honored. I want to thank Dr. Winters for joining us tonight, for sharing from your interesting life, and being so vulnerable. You've treated us to some fine art, the art of storytelling, and you've also reminded us of what life is all about. A search for purpose, meaning, for something more than just punching a time clock or following blindly in our Father's footsteps. You've also shown us that the way we navigate this search can have a profound impact on our relationships, on our self-esteem, our mental health, and whether we survive in this sometimes cold and unfriendly world. In other words, stories can help us deal with some very serious stuff. Scooter is up next with The Inner Side to complete the backside of this Power Hour on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So, What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. Keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. Till next week, Hank, Greg, Laura, Jacob, Michael, and I remind you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Machine drives neocon, jingoistic, warmongering, theocratic, faux populist, anti-intellectual, drillaholic, social Darwinist, racist, sexist, isolationist, hardline, strip mine, teabag, Confederate flag, birthers, screaming from the room.
Roy Zimmerman brings the sting of satire to the struggle for peace and justice. He'll make you smile with funny songs about peace, hypocrisy, greedy corporations, and intolerance. The Houston Peace and Justice Center is bringing him to town Friday, March 11th, to a fundraiser for Peace Camp Houston at the Unitarian Fellowship, 1504 Wirt Road in Houston. The show starts at 7:30 p.m. An optional potluck dinner will be just before the show at 6:30 p.m. for anyone wanting to share food and drinks and company. For details and to get advanced